We regularly feature interesting stories from the Washington Post magazine, and this past Sunday's edition features quite an adventure. The Post's South America correspondent, Monty Real, talked to some staff of FUNAI, the Brazilian government agency that is responsible for protecting Indian interests and culture. One of the things they do is make contact with indigenous people deep in the country's rainforests. A longtime member of the FUNAI staff confirmed a local rumor when his team came across a man who was possibly the only remaining member of his tribe. The FUNAI team spent hours trying to communicate with the man who nearly took one of them out with an arrow. Believe it or not, the story gets more interesting from there. Monty Real, thanks for talking with us.
Thanks for having me.
And thanks for this piece, which is, I have to say, riveting. How did you get interested in this? How did you even know about this?
In 2005, I was in Brazil's capital in Brasilia, and I was working on an unrelated story about another Indian tribe in another state, and I met a man named Sidney Pozuelo, and he was telling me stories about the isolated tribes that are located throughout the country. And while I was talking to him, his son, Orlando, happened to walk into the apartment, and he had just come back from a expedition in Rondônia. And it turns out it was the latest expedition to try to make contact with this lone Indian. Ranch hands and workers from the local logging operations had been telling a story about a lone Indian who was rumored to live completely disconnected from any of the other tribes in the area. This rumor seized Marcelo dos Santos and Altair Alguer. They were the leaders of the FUNAI team. FUNAI for years had unsuccessfully been trying to contact him, and on this expedition that Orlando recently had returned from, one of the team members was actually shot with an arrow whenever he tried to approach the Indian. So I became fascinated with that story.
How do these uncontacted people live?
It's an amazing, just the effort that it takes for mere survival. I met Pará, who is a member of the expedition team, and he was a member of a small five-person tribe that the team had encountered just months before this. He had never had contact with the outside world before that, so he provides sort of a window on what it's like day-to-day for the lone Indian who, in how he survives and how he spends his days. Basically, a lot of the time is consumed in hunting. He hunts with a bow and arrow. He has to make the bow himself, has to carve the arrows out of bamboo using instruments such as stones, and for files, he uses the teeth of a large rodent called a paca. To gather honey, it's a major time-consuming process where he taps into trees using stone axes. So that pretty much takes up all of the daylight hours, just mere survival.
And as I mentioned, how the team finds these folks is quite an adventure. If I could get you to read just a paragraph from your story where you describe it very vividly.
Yes. They stood still and listened. Amid the ever-present chorus of birdsong, they heard a rustling. The Indian was near the trap that they'd just discovered. They walked toward him, but he disappeared. It was as if he'd found a crack in the deep green curtain of foliage behind him and quietly slipped off stage. They spread out at random angles until Altair saw something about 200 yards off the trail, a small thatch hut, the same kind that they had found hastily abandoned elsewhere in the forest. This time, the Indian was inside. They approached very slowly. "Hi, my friend," Altair said. There was no response, but through a slight gap in the thatch, Altair could see the man's eyes.
And so they did encounter him. What happened to him?
Well, they spent several hours in what was essentially a standoff. They approached the hut slowly, and they tried to communicate to him that they were friendly. For example, Altair tied some food on the end of a stick and pushed it up towards the opening in the hut. The Indian took the food, but then just minutes later, tore it up and threw it back out at them as a signal that he didn't want to make this contact. But they continued to try. And as they got closer to the hut, they noticed that the Indian was sticking an arrow outside of the thatch and twisting it in place. There was one member of the team who had a video camera. And when the Indian saw the video camera, later they suspect that he thought it was a weapon. And that's when the Indian shot the arrow, narrowly missed the cameraman's chest. And at that time, Pourra, the Kanoe Indian who had accompanied them on the expedition, he saw what was happening and was extremely frightened, and he ran away through the forest. So that first meeting was not successful in contacting him, as none of the subsequent meetings have been.
Well, you got a chance to go down there and see the area. Did you ever see him?
No, and I didn't try to. Right now, the policy of Funai has changed. They're no longer trying to force contact. From their point of view, they think they've given him the opportunity and he's rejected it. So what they've done is set up a small campsite adjacent to the land where he lives, in the hopes that if he wants to initiate contact, he'll come to them.
Why is that?
Because they've determined that he's given signals that he doesn't want to, first of all, through, the very obvious signal of trying to shoot the members when they approached. And they've come to the conclusion that making contact probably would not be beneficial for him. It would obviously change his lifestyle completely. The reason that they wanted to originally make contact with him would be to protect him, to let him know that ranchers and loggers were encroaching on his area, and they feared that there could be a clash. But now they've protected his area. They've deemed it off limits to development last year. So their philosophy now is to stand back, let him live out his life. If he is in danger and senses danger, he can come and contact them, but they don't want to be the ones to force that contact.
And your story makes clear that FUNAI is a controversial agency in Brazil. Everybody's not kind of on board with this idea of setting land aside to help these indigenous folks, maintain their life. Why is that?
Well, land is, it's a very thorny issue in Brazil. The Amazonian basin is about 90% the size of the continental US. So it's in just a massive area of land. And for a lot of Brazilians, that area is, prime for development. They see so many natural resources there to be exploited, and they don't like other people telling them what they should be doing with it.
Do some people feel that it's morally or ethically wrong to leave people in such a difficult life circumstance? Because their lifestyle, as you pointed out, is arduous. It's very dangerous. And personally, for me, from an existential standpoint, humans are social beings. I can't
Exactly.
imagine being alone for the rest of my life. I don't know.
Yeah, no, it's definitely a topic that's been debated a lot. Brazil used to have a policy of assimilation. They would try to make contact with tribes and try to bring them into modern society. But there were a few things that led to an evolution away from that way of thinking. In the 1970s, there were several incidents with tribes that had been encountered that were just disastrous. There was one tribe encountered in, I believe it was 1972, had about 400 members at the time. And after 5 or 6 years after contact, 80% of those members had died. And the causes for those deaths were diseases that they hadn't been exposed to before, such as flu or chickenpox. Others were involved in conflicts, clashes with other tribes. They had been moved to a reserve area and placed next to tribes that they had no historical relationship with. And they simply clashed, and there were but bloody conflicts. So after that, the government's policy, official policy, became that they would contact isolated Indians only if those Indians were under a clear danger.
That's remarkable. Monte Rio, South America correspondent for the Washington Post. If you want to read his story in its entirety, we have a link on our website, npr.org/tellmemore. Monte, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.